Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Raed Jarar, an Iraqi-born political analyst who discusses his view that renewed U.S. military intervention in Iraq will draw America deeper into that nation's civil conflict linked with others across the region. Veteran peace and social justice organizer Leslie Kagan, who previews the upcoming September 21st People's Climate March in New York City, expected to be the largest climate change protest in world history. And Susan Hanley, manager of the Paul Smith's Butterfly House in upstate New York, who explains why the monarch butterfly is rapidly disappearing across the eastern half of the United States. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The balance of power shifted quickly in Tripoli, capital of Libya, after the city's international airport was taken over by an Islamist militia after weeks of fighting between heavily armed rival ethnic armies. Growing conflict in the oil-rich nation could drive Libya into a civil war, as two rival parliaments in different cities claimed legitimacy, each backed by their own militia groups and funding from different Arab and Persian Gulf governments. During the height of the recent fighting in late August, jet fighters flown by pilots from the United Arab Emirates and launched from Egypt targeted Libyan Islamist fighters. Although the airstrikes failed to prevent the Islamist takeover of the airport, the outside intervention by the UAE and Egypt alarmed Western powers. The U.S. and Europe assert that military support for Libya's warring factions will not help restore stability and that only dialogue and negotiations can end the conflict. By their actions, the governments of the UAE and Egypt disagree. Louisiana's Republican Governor Bobby Jindal filed a lawsuit against the Obama administration to overturn federal Common Core educational standards. 4 years ago, when it was first rolled out, Jindal was a big supporter of Common Core. Louisiana won $17 million in grants that provided incentives for states to set up college and career-ready educational standards. However, in recent months, as Jindal ponders a race for the GOP presidential nomination, he's tried to pull Louisiana out of Common Core, but was blocked by the state's education officials. When the Common Core standards were launched in 2010, over two-thirds of the nation's governors quickly adopted the new academic standards in a process guided by state education departments and the National Governors Association. Common Core was initiated by two academic researchers, David Coleman and Jason Zimba, and backed by the Gates Foundation with $200 million in grants. Over time, an intense backlash against Common Core has grown on both the right and left. Tea Party activists railed against what opponents have dubbed Obama Core, and right-wing pundit Glenn Beck blasted Common Core standards as slavery. Critics on the left say Common Core and the push for continual testing drives up inequality, damages the confidence of low-income students, and is an unfair measurement of teacher performance. Mark Nason, a Fordham University history professor, told Mother Jones magazine that only 15% of African-American students passed the first round of Common Core math tests in New York State. Nason calls such testing child abuse. Si Se Puede is a cleaning service cooperative in Brooklyn, New York, with 64 worker owners. In 2013, the cooperative grossed over $1 million in revenue, is branding its own line of cleaning supplies, and pays each of its staff members over $20 an hour. In June, the New York City Council approved a new initiative funded with $1.2 million to create new worker-owner cooperatives and several hundred good-paying jobs. According to the news magazine In These Times, New York City is the first city to invest public dollars in creating new worker cooperatives. The initiative won the backing of progressive Mayor Bill de Blasio, but the city council only approved 1 year of funding, raising some concerns about the long-term viability of the project. Worker co-ops in the United States date back to colonial times and witnessed a surge during the late 1960s and early 70s. According to data from the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives, roughly 300 worker-owned cooperatives are in operation across the nation in fields ranging from engineering, architecture, and computer technology to taxi driving, house cleaning, and construction. The inspiration for the recent wave of new co-ops is the success of Spain's Mondragon initiative that now employs over 80,000 workers in 300 firms. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Since President Barack Obama first authorized military intervention in northern Iraq on August 7th, the mission has expanded from the originally stated humanitarian purpose of protecting minority Yazidi refugees and the U.S. consulate in the Kurdish city of Erbil, threatened by advancing fighters of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, or ISIS. Later, U.S. airstrikes were launched in support of Iraqi and Kurdish forces as they successfully fought ISIS for control of the strategic Mosul Dam. On Labor Day, President Obama formally notified the U.S. Congress that he had ordered additional airstrikes and humanitarian airdrops over the Iraqi Shia town of Amerli, where the administration said ISIS militants had trapped the civilian population. The Iraqi army, along with Shia militia groups, reportedly drove ISIS forces out of Amerli on August 31st. By mid-August, the U.S. had deployed nearly 1,000 military advisors to Iraq. As Mr. Obama prepared to fly to Europe to attend the NATO summit meeting that begins in Wales on September 4th, ISIS posted a gruesome video that showed the beheading of U.S. journalist Stephen Sotloff. Sotloff, who wrote for Time magazine and other publications, was the second American executed by the Islamic militant group after the August 19th murder of journalist James Foley. ISIS has threatened to kill a third Western captive, British citizen David Cawthorn Haynes, if the U.S. doesn't end its military operations in Iraq. Your reporter spoke with Raed Jarar, an Iraqi-born political analyst who now serves as the Policy Impact Coordinator with the American Friends Service Committee Office of Public Policy. Here he discusses his view that renewed U.S. military intervention in Iraq will draw America deeper into Iraq's civil conflict, link with others across the region.
The Pentagon put an official statement a week after President Obama announced his intention to bomb Iraq to stop what he described as a genocide going on in the country. And according to the Pentagon's own statement, there were 20 advisors who landed on the mountain that the president said the genocide was taking place around. And the Pentagon says that they don't feel that there is a huge humanitarian crisis there. The number of people is way less, and they have access to water and food. And they didn't think that the U.S. should help evacuate them or interfere in that particular area. So that's according to the U.S. government itself. And, you know, it's all very obvious that there are many shades of gray between calling a humanitarian situation a genocide, which is an extremely serious allegation, and between having the Pentagon say that isn't really a very serious situation. So I was personally very disturbed by the president's use of the word genocide, because it seems that he uses it very lightly to describe the situation without verifying first. There are, you know, international mechanisms to respond to such claims and actions such as genocide. These don't include unilateral U.S. military intervention. They include multilateral and international response to try to stop genocide as soon as possible.
By most accounts, the actions of ISIS on the ground in northern Iraq have been quite brutal. There have been videos released by the group that show hundreds of Iraqi soldiers and civilians being killed, slaughtered one after the other in these horrendous films. And understandably, the U.S. public not wanting another military intervention, but certainly their humanitarian instincts kick in when they see defenseless people shot in the head by the hundreds. When you see the intervention now being conducted in the form of airstrikes over northern Iraq, do you feel that this response by the United States will make things worse?
As you mentioned correctly, I think the U.S. public have been exposed to gruesome images of the crimes of ISIS in Iraq and in Syria. And these crimes, many of them have been verified. They are catastrophic crimes. They are really horrible crimes. They include killing and torturing people. They include acts of ethnic and sectarian cleansing, destruction of important sites in Iraq. What the U.S. public has not been exposed to as much is the crimes of the other groups in Iraq, you know, including the U.S. allies in Iraq. So the Iraqi government, funded by U.S. taxpayers' money, and the sectarian militias affiliated and supported by the Iraqi government, have been committing crimes, if not the same, it might be even worse than the crimes of ISIS. Human Rights Watch put a report a few weeks ago accusing the Iraqi authorities of committing war crimes by dropping indiscriminate bombs on civilian neighborhoods in Sunni areas that fell out of the control of the Iraqi government, Fallujah and elsewhere. Shiite militias funded by the Iraqi government, so indirectly supported by the U.S., have been committing crimes against humanity in many places in the country. The last one happened last week or 10 days ago. They invaded a small mosque in the province of Diyala, and they opened fire, killing 70 people who were praying, 70 Sunnis who were praying. 2 weeks before that, they went to the same town, rounded up every Sunni man that they could get a hold of, shot them in the head, and put their dead bodies on light poles on the street. So the point that I'm driving here is that the situation is that there are many criminal groups that are almost as bad as each other. And the U.S. is not really emphasizing the crimes that its allies are committing. And it's emphasizing the crimes, of what they call a terrorist organization.
Raid, before we run out of time, I wanted to ask you this. Spokespeople for the ISIS militant group have often gone on video released to the world saying that they welcome U.S. intervention. And I don't know if that's just bravado or they really do desire the United States to become involved in the conflict in northern Iraq and Syria in a big way, which may, of course, happen. But what is it that they think will be the result of U.S. intervention that will favor them in terms of their tactics and strategy?
It's very hard to verify if these statements are really coming from the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. I see the argument behind these claims that a U.S. intervention would help recruit more Iraqis to join these groups, because the Iraqis, in their nature, and most of the people around the world, don't like foreign interventions in their land. And I have heard a few groups here in the U.S. saying we shouldn't bomb Iraq because that makes the Islamic State stronger. You know, that might be the case, that might not be the case. The U.S. Bombing might actually harm or weaken these terrorist groups. Even if the U.S. bombing will weaken this group by dropping some bombs, that's not a strategic solution. That's not a long-term solution. They might have some short-term impact. But on the longer term, they will have even more devastating results than where we stand now.
That was Raed Jarar, an Iraqi-born political analyst who now serves as the policy impact coordinator with the American Friends Service Committee's Office of Public Policy. Find more analysis and commentary on President Obama's authorization of U.S. airstrikes in Iraq targeting ISIS by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In February, climate change activist groups 350.org and Avaaz called for a protest march in New York City on Sunday, September 21st, just days before President Obama and other world leaders are scheduled to attend an emergency climate summit at the United Nations headquarters. Since the call went out, nearly 1,000 organizations around the world have signed on in support of the People's Climate March, forming a coalition that includes environmental groups, religious organizations, and labor unions. As activists in New York demand the world's political leaders go beyond rhetoric and commit to bold action to address climate change at the UN summit, simultaneous demonstrations are being organized around the globe. Dozens of events, including teach-ins, a climate change convergence conference, and nonviolent civil disobedience actions, are being organized both before and after the People's Climate March, which is expected to be the largest climate change protest in world history. The march, however, has drawn criticism from some activist groups for shunning a specific list of demands and organizing a protest event with no speakers to articulate the action's message. Your reporter spoke with Leslie Kagan, a lifelong political activist who has organized some of the nation's largest political protests for the peace, anti-nuclear, civil rights, LGBT, feminist, Central American solidarity, and anti-apartheid movements. Leslie, former national coordinator with United for Peace and Justice, the group which brought together hundreds of thousands of people for major anti-Iraq war protests before and after the 2003 U.S. invasion, now serves as one of the primary organizers of the September 21st People's Climate March. Here she talks about the goals of the march and its importance to the global climate movement.
We've put together over the last several months a very broad network coalition grouping. There's now over 950 organizations that are on board, and I'm sure the next three weeks or so, this will top 1,000 groups, not only some of the kind of, you know, long-standing environmental, climate crisis, environmental justice organizations, but a full range of social and economic justice groups, organizations and institutions in the religious communities, students and youth, seniors, young people, you know, just a full range of different types of people, really from just about every walk of life, who understand, even if the heads of state refuse to do anything about it, that the people understand there is a serious global crisis. And if action isn't taken now, we could be, you know, at a point very soon where it's too late. So that's the bottom line. We are hitting the streets in massive numbers from a broad range of communities and constituencies, and saying that you can't just gather for a nice meeting in New York with a lot of fancy rhetoric. You have to take action. And because we are such a broad range of different kinds of groups and organizations, we actually don't have a set of specific demands. Each organization, each group will be carrying its own demands, its own issue focus, concerns in their contingents when they march on Sunday the 21st.
As you said, there are no demands for the People's Climate March and no list of speakers that will be delivering a message, a specific message from the march. I've heard some criticism to the effect that in an effort to have a really big tent and massive numbers of people, that the message will be diluted and therefore that this is a missed opportunity to be very specific about what should happen.
Well, I understand that. I mean, I can see how people might reach that conclusion. On the other hand, though, I think this approach for this day, for this activity, does make sense. First of all, I think there is a demand, not a specific policy demand, but there is, in just the fact that so many people will be marching, there is a demand for action to stop with the rhetoric, stop with the nice speeches, and take some serious action. So that's not, like I said, a specific policy demand or do X, Y, Z. It's a much broader kind of call. It's more a call than a demand. But that's okay. The reality is that this climate crisis is unfolding in many ways on many fronts and hitting many different communities and constituencies, not only all around this country, but all around the world. And so people experience it differently and focus on a particular piece of it. And it's really not as if one particular constituency is right and another one is wrong, or that you could set a priority. All of these are important. And the climate crisis also relates to a host of other, you know, assaults on the environment that need to be linked in as well. And there are economic dimensions to this. So instead of having a list of 20 issues, we thought it would make sense rather to show that, you know, the range of different kinds of organizations and communities and constituencies that are coming together in this moment of global climate crisis and saying basically enough is enough, it's time to act.
Well, Leslie, when people leave the People's Climate March on September 21st, what activities will be encouraged or education will be available on how people can get involved at the grassroots level where they live?
Right. We're actually beginning that discussion now. Are there some particular campaigns and projects that we're going to push out and encourage people to get involved in? And I encourage people, even though it's going to be a long and dynamic day, to stay to the end, because the closing activities will be an opportunity for people to not only just, you know, pick up literature and sign petitions, but more importantly, or just as importantly, to connect to different organizations and projects. So there'll be students talking about the divestment campaigns on many campuses around the country. They want to expand that. They want more campuses to take up efforts to divest their schools, the investments that their schools make in companies that are basically profiting off the climate crisis. So there's many, many ways to get involved, from, you know, organizing educational campaigns to passing resolutions in your organizations, to getting involved in projects like, you know, like campus divestment or neighborhood resiliency work and everything else that you could imagine.
That was veteran progressive activist Leslie Kagan, one of the primary organizers of the September 21st People's Climate March in New York City. Find more information on the Climate March and dozens of related events by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Late summer is the season when monarch butterflies begin their migration from the northeast and midwest of the United States to their wintering grounds in the Oyamel fir forest of Mexico. But this year, the monarchs are in crisis. Many observers report seeing very few or no monarchs at all during the summer months this year, when in the recent past, they were common all over the eastern half of the U.S. In fact, researchers have found that over the last two decades, the monarch butterfly population has declined by 90% in the eastern U.S. Scientists say there are several reasons for the monarch's population crash that include deforestation of the insect's breeding areas in Mexico, the negative effects of GMO crops, and the destruction of milkweed, the plant where monarchs exclusively lay their eggs. Fortunately, there are things that can be done to help these iconic creatures survive. Three major conservation groups have called on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to designate the monarch as a threatened species, an action that would give federal officials the power to launch new initiatives to protect their habitat. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Sue Hanley, native species butterfly house manager at the Paul Smith Visitors Interpretive Center in the Adirondack Mountains in upstate New York. She explains that the monarchs we see now are the great-grandchildren of the ones who were last seen in the Northeast and Midwest, as it takes four generations for them to make the round-trip journey from Mexico. Here she describes the threats facing the monarchs, as well as individual and organizational responses to those challenges.
The monarch originated in South America and followed milkweed north through Mexico and North America. So there is a population in Florida that, by and large, does not migrate. They just shift north and south within Florida. And there is a western migration west of the Rockies that goes to the coast to overwinter, the coast of California and down into Baja. But the eastern migration was, of course, always the largest, being the northeast and the midwest and all funneling down into Mexico. And that's the migration that's been so hard hit. There are too many things going wrong from the monarchs. Unfortunately, they're all pretty much based on human behavior. It's a combination of deforestation in Mexico for their overwintering spot, GMO corn, which is Roundup ready so that you can spray indiscriminately. Their milkweed gets sprayed so they don't have any, or their milkweed gets sprayed and it's poisonous to eat. Roadside mowing. There are so many things that we do that are harmful to monarchs, and they just can't handle it anymore.
It's interesting that the monarch lays its eggs only on milkweed plants, and the monarch caterpillars that hatch out eat only milkweed. That seems like it might hinder their survival.
Most butterflies and moths are specific to a plant that they want as their host plant for their caterpillars, so they will only lay their eggs on the plant that they want. And monarchs have chosen milkweed because that white sap in the milkweed has cardiac glycosides. It makes their predators very ill. Predators with a spine and a nervous system feel nausea or vomiting when they eat a monarch, and they learn not to, and they learn to teach their offspring not to eat a monarch. So it was a very good choice on the monarch's part. The only predators the monarch has are other insects. They are not affected by the toxin. But unfortunately, milkweed is something that is considered a noxious weed to to farmers here in the States. It has just been delisted in Canada as being a noxious weed, so they are going to have an easier time conserving their milkweed than we are.
Sue Hanley, butterflies have this mythic reputation of representing freedom and beauty and playfulness, and of course there's value just in that. But do they serve a broader purpose besides being beautiful?
Yes, besides being beautiful, butterflies have a dual purpose. They are pollinators, not always as efficient as bees, but they are very good pollinators. And they are also a huge food source for birds, bats, rodents, frogs, and snakes. Of course, now there are not as many of them to be a food source for those animals, so they are jeopardizing other animals too.
If Roundup is such a huge contributor to the fall-off in the monarch population, is there anything being done to pressure Monsanto, the producer of Roundup, to do something about this terrible problem?
One of the agencies leading the charge now is the Friends of the Earth. And yes, they are doing a lot of citizen science actions and legislative actions. And they are doing a great job. But because Monsanto is so powerful and has so much money, the Monarch Watch folks have decided that as a community, we who care about monarchs need to be planting organic way station gardens and doing everything we can to feed them and care for them, because we can't exactly wait until somebody is able to get through to Monsanto. It may not happen. People are very concerned and wanting to help because the monarch is a beloved butterfly. And people mostly are saying, I'm used to seeing lots of them and I don't anymore. Why? When they find out that human beings are why, they want to make amends. They want to do something. And there's so much you can do. Even if you're already growing milkweed, you can add bright colored nectar flowers so that the overflying monarchs will see your milkweed. They'll see the bright flower and come use your milkweed. If you're doing that, you know, and you notice eggs on your plants, why not go to the hardware store and get some paint strainers and put them over the plants and make sure that those caterpillars go to maturity and become monarchs.
That was Susan Hanley, native species butterfly house manager at the Paul Smith Visitors Interpretive Center in upstate New York. For more information on the disappearance of the monarch butterfly and what can be done to save the species, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.